Steiner leaned back in his chair, his eyes worried, one hand playing with the pastoral scepter of his office. He sat that way for several seconds, then looked back up at Merlin.
"Exactly where are you heading, Merlin?"
"To Zion, I think," Merlin replied. This time, Steiner's eyes didn't even flicker. He clearly didn't like where this seemed to be bound, but it was equally clear he wasn't surprised.
"How?"
he asked simply. "What I have in mind isn't really all that complicated. A bit risky, perhaps, but not complicated."
"You fill me with dread,"
Steiner said dryly, and Merlin chuckled. "Actually, what started me thinking about it was something Charlian said earlier this morning. She and Caleb are planning on sending me to Coruscant with you to keep an eye on you. As she pointed out to Caleb, we can stay in communication now wherever I am, and it would actually make sense for Caleb to send his personal armsman to protect the Archbishop of Carus. But if they can send me to Coruscant and stay in touch, then I could send myself to Zion without dropping out of contact as well."
"And just go strolling around the city? In your Imperial Guard uniform, no doubt?"
"Not quite." Merlin smiled slightly. "In fact, I can reconfigure my Pika, Your Eminence. There are limits to the amount of change I can crank in on things like height, but I can alter the color of my hair, the color of my eyes, my complexion." He shrugged. "Trust me, I am a true master of disguise. Or perhaps I should say, mistress." Steiner nodded. He'd seen file imagery of Nemu Alban now, and he had to admit that no one would ever have recognized her in Merlin Athrawis. There was an obvious, and certainly understandable, family resemblance between them, but Merlin was unmistakably a man.
"I won't pretend getting me and all the electronics tucked away inside me, not to mention my power plant, that close to the temple doesn't make me nervous," Merlin continued. "But no one who sees or meets me is going to associate me with Merlin Athrawis. Not even if they later meet Merlin."
"All right, I can see that," Steiner conceded.
"Well, while I'm admitting things, I suppose I should also admit I'll be pretty much playing things by ear once I get there."
Merlin shrugged.
"It can't be any other way. But I'll have several advantages Angelic doesn't have. And I can always explain that I'm another Sajan, a friend of Sajan Merlin's who's rallied around to help him out, for example. That should help account for some of those advantages if I have to call on them in front of witnesses."
"And just exactly where is Sajan Merlin going to be while all of this is going on?"
Steiner shook his head.
"You're going to have to be gone at least several days, more probably for 5 days.
"That's one of the reasons I came to see you," Merlin said. "I think we can probably cover at least a short absence on my part by using the stories about Sajans. According to at least some of the tales, they need to withdraw from the world to meditate from time to time. Sajan Merlin, on the other hand, has been continually on duty ever since he first arrived in Carus. No doubt he's long overdue for that sort of withdrawal. Call it a spiritual retreat. Given the fact that Caleb and Charlian want to send me to Coruscant with you, and that all they're going to be doing themselves for the immediate future is to stay parked here in the palace with oodles of guardsmen to keep an eye on them for me, I think we could get away with explaining to anyone who asks that I'm taking this opportunity for the aforesaid spiritual retreat before you and I depart."
"I imagine we could do that," Steiner agreed slowly, his eyes thoughtful.
"The problem is that we have to convince Caleb and Charlian to go along with all this."
Merlin's lips twitched in something halfway between a smile and a grimace.
"I don't think either of them's going to be happy with the notion,
but I'm not about to set out on something like this without keeping them fully informed. We just, had a little conversation about exactly that point, as a matter of fact." His expression turned into a true smile for a moment, then smoothed. "However, I can't tell them where I want to go and why without telling them about Angelic, Your Eminence. And I can't do that if it would violate your confidence and the sanctity of the confessional."
"I see," Stainer said again.
He sat for well over 2 minutes, thinking hard, then his eyes refocused on Merlin.
"This is an awkward situation," he said. "First, you're already party to the information covered by the confessional seal. Technically, that means you don't need my permission to share that information, information which came into your possession through no intentional violation of the confessional, with Caleb and Charlian. For that matter, you're not even a churchman, so the seal of the confessional wouldn't apply to you in the first place. You and I both know that that's simply a legalistic argument, though."
Merlin nodded silently, and Stainer drew a deep breath.
"As Archbishop, I have the authority to release the seal of the confessional under certain clearly delineated circumstances. Frankly, I wouldn't even consider violating it for most of the justifications the Church of God Awaiting recognizes, since they mostly have to do with turning people over to the Inquisition. However, even the Church of Langhorne recognizes that there are instances in which the immediate safety of others must be considered. That's obviously true in this case. And unfortunately, there's no possible way for me to consult with Adderai and ask her permission in time to do any good. At the same time, I have to tell you that if it were not for the imminence of the threat to Madame Angelic and the innocent people you say she's trying to help escape, I wouldn't even consider this. You understand that?"
Merlin simply nodded once more, and Stainer sighed.
"All right, Merlin. Given the situation, I'll support you with Caleb and Charlian."
14. Madame Angelic Ponda's Townhouse, City of Zion, the Temple Lands. Soft music drifted through the luxuriously appointed sitting room. Richly attired men, most in cotton silk and steel thistle silk cassocks, several in the orange of vicars, sat or stood around the room, holding wine glasses or snifters of brandy. Business was always good at Madame Angelic's, and never better than during the winter months, when the citizens of Zion turned inevitably to inside occupations. Young women, of all castes of complexion but uniformly lovely, sat or stood with their guests, chatting easily, laughing. All of them were tastefully dressed, most with elegantly understated cosmetics. Anything less like the popular concept of prostitutes would have been difficult to imagine. Which was precisely why Madame Angelic had always been so successful. No vulgarians among her young ladies, no common or crude or coarse conversation, no lowbrow humor. Madame Angelic's courtesans were all intelligent, lively, well-educated. They were encouraged to read, to follow the latest news, to discuss any subject which might arise with combined wit and tact. They attracted only the very highest quality clients, and it was known throughout the temple hierarchy that Madame Angelic's ladies were unfailingly discreet. Angelic's standards were high, but no higher than the ones she'd met during her own working girl days. And it was astounding how many members of the vicarate stood on intimate terms with her, even today. Now she made her way across the room, pausing for a brief word here and there with those she knew particularly well. A graceful caressing touch upon a shoulder, a chaste kiss on a cheek for the more favored, a laughing smile, a jest for others.
No one looking at her could have guessed she felt the least concern about anything. Of course, one of the very first requirements of a successful courtesan was acting ability. Her head turned as she caught movement out of the corner of one eye, and then an eyebrow rose as a well-dressed man she'd never before seen entered the room. He was tall, clean-shaven, with hazel eyes. His brown hair was a bit longer than current Zion fashion dictated, pulled back in a simple ponytail confined by a jeweled clasp, and the heavy, snow-dusted overcoat he'd just handed to the porter was trimmed with a mountain slash lizard's white winter pelt. A heavy golden chain around his neck and equally golden rings on his well-manicured fingers were additional indications of affluence, and Angelic's still lovely brow furrowed slightly in speculative interest. "Excuse me," she murmured to her current conversational partner. "I believe I see someone I should be greeting, Your Eminence."
"Certainly, my dear," the Archbishop to whom she'd been speaking replied.
"Thank you," she said, smiling warmly at him. She drifted gracefully towards the newcomer, who was looking about him, not obtrusively but with obvious interest. He spotted her approach, and she smiled once again, more broadly, as she extended a slim hand.
"Welcome," she said simply.
"Thank you," he replied in a pleasant tenor voice. He lifted her hand gallantly to his lips and kissed it. "I have the pleasure of addressing Madame Angelic herself, I hope?" he asked.
"Indeed you do, sir," she acknowledged. "And you are?"
"Abraham Jevons." He bowed slightly and she nodded. He spoke with a slight but recognizable Desnarian accent, she thought.
"Are you a visitor to our city, Master Jevons? Please call me Abraham."
White teeth flashed in a charming smile, and his hazel eyes smiled at her as well.
"Indeed I am. Has my accent given me away? Do I sound too rustic?" "Oh, hardly rustic, Abraham."
Her silvery laugh was as charming as all the rest of her.
"But I did seem to detect at least a little accent. Desnarian?" "Almost."
His smile turned just a bit impish.
"Silkayan, actually." "Oh, forgive me."
Her laugh was a little louder this time. Many citizens of the Grand Duchy of Silkaya resented being identified as Desnarians.
"There's nothing to forgive," he assured her. "And if there were, it would be my pleasure to extend that forgiveness to someone as charming as yourself." "You don't seem to have been stinted upon charm yourself, Abraham," she observed. "My parents would like to think not, at any rate. May I ask what brings you to Zion at this time of year?"
Angelic grimaced delicately.
"While I would never question the Archangel's judgment, I've sometimes wondered what they were thinking to place the temple somewhere with Zion's winter climate. It does make travel to the city a bit arduous at this time of year," he acknowledged with a slight shrug. "Unfortunately, business required my presence here. And however arduous the journey, the company waiting at the other end of the trip has certainly made it worthwhile." "I'm glad you think so. Shall I introduce you to one of my young ladies?"
Angelic's tone was as courteous and gracious as ever, yet somehow it contrived to make it perfectly clear that her own working days were behind her. Jevons seemed amused by the implication.
"I think that would be a very good idea," he said. "I do trust, however, that we'll have the opportunity for at least a little more conversation." "Oh, I'm sure we will," she assured him, taking his hand and tucking it into her own elbow with a proprietary air as she led him across the sitting room towards a stunningly attractive, blue-eyed, golden-haired young woman.
"Abraham, allow me to introduce Marlis," Angelic said. "Marlis, this is Abraham. He's just arrived from Silkaya."
"Really?"
Marlis gave Jevons a dazzling smile,
Oh, I know why Madame introduced you to me, Abraham.
So do I, Jevons replied as he recognized her own considerably stronger accent.
Do I detect the accent of Silktown itself?
You do indeed, Angelic assured him, passing his captive hand across to Marlis. I thought you might find it comforting this far from home.
Oh, Jevons smiled broadly. I'm sure I'll find it very comforting.
Several hours later, the sitting room was virtually deserted when Abraham Jevons re-entered it. Marlis Farno accompanied him, and the smile on her face was more than merely professional, Angelic thought, as they approached her. That was good. Marlis was one of her favorites, and she'd hoped the young woman would find Jevons pleasant company. First impressions could always be misleading, however, and she was glad this one apparently had not been.
Are you leaving us, Abraham?
I'm afraid I must, he replied. I have a meeting tomorrow morning to discuss one of the shipbuilding contracts. I need to be rested before I match wits with Vicar Robert's minions.
A very wise attitude.
So I've been told. He smiled at her. Before I leave, however, I wondered if I might have a word in private.
In private?
Her eyebrows arched.
I have a request to make for a friend.
I see.
Angelic's expression was only politely attentive, but mental ears pricked at something about her guest's tone. It was very slight, whatever it was, almost more imagined than heard. Yet it was there. She was oddly certain of that.
Of course, she invited after the very briefest of hesitations, and gestured gracefully at one of the small side rooms. Will that be sufficiently private?
Perfectly, he assured her, and offered her his arm. They strolled across the all-but-deserted room, chatting easily, and Jevons casually closed the smaller chamber's door behind them. Then he turned to face Angelic.
And now, Abraham, she said, about this request of yours?
It's really quite simple, he told her. Adarai would appreciate your joining her in Caris.
Despite literally decades of hard-won experience and discipline, Angelic's eyes flew wide. She stared at him for a fleeting instant, then paled as she realized how she had betrayed herself. One slim hand rose to her throat, and her fingers closed on a locket she wore about her neck on a silken riband.
Don't, Jevons said gently.
She stared at him, eyes huge, and he shook his head.
I don't think Adarai would be very happy if you swallowed that cyanide tablet, Ninian.
She froze, scarcely breathing, and he smiled crookedly at her.
I know what you're thinking, but think a bit harder. If Clinton and Raynal suspected you, if they knew enough to know the name your aunt and uncle gave you, they'd have no reason to entrap you. You'd already be in custody.
She gazed at him, color slowly creeping back into her face, but she didn't take her hand from the locket.
That depends, she said after another long pause, and her voice was astonishingly steady under the circumstances. I can think of a few scenarios in which tricking me into trusting you could be more useful, advantageous at least, than simply arresting me and putting me to the question.
I'm sure you can, he nodded. At the same time, I think you know Clinton better than that.
Reno,
he shrugged slightly, might be subtle enough to attempt something like that, but Clinton?
He shook his head.
Not in your case. Not if he began even to suspect all of the documentary evidence you sent to Adarai in Telisburg. Or, for that matter, that you were the one who got her and the boys out of the temple lands in the first place.
Her eyes narrowed at the further evidence of how much he knew about her.
And he's right, she thought with an inner shiver she didn't allow to touch her eyes.
If that pig Clintan had any idea of how much damage I've done, I'd be screaming in one of the Inquisition's questioning chambers this very instant, and I'd go on screaming for a very long time.
All right, she said finally, although her fingers remained in contact with the locket.
I'll assume you're really from Adirai. There doesn't,
she smiled very crookedly,
seem to be a great deal of point in pretending I don't know what you're talking about, at any rate. But why did she send you? Why now?
To be perfectly honest, he said carefully, she didn't send me. She doesn't even know I'm here.
But you said...
Her hand tightened around the locket again.
Gently.
His own hand shot out with blinding speed, more quickly than she'd ever seen or imagined a human hand could move. It closed on her wrist, and her eyes flew wide. Its grip was almost absurdly gentle, yet it might as well have been a steel vise. She jerked against it with all of her strength, hard enough she actually staggered half a step forward, and it didn't move a fraction of an inch.
I said she doesn't know I'm here, Angelic, he said quietly. I also said she'd like you to join her in Telesburg. Both of those statements were accurate. What do you mean?
She abandoned her useless effort to pull free of his grip, and her eyes narrowed once more, speculatively.
I'm sure that even here in Zion, you've heard stories about Sage in Merlin and his service to Karis.
Jevon's tone made the statement a question, and she nodded. He shrugged.
Well, you might say I'm cut from the same cloth as the Sagen, and Archbishop Michael and Merlin became aware of certain events transpiring here in Zion. On the basis of what they'd learned, the two of them decided it would be wise to send me here. Unfortunately, there wasn't time for them to explain their fears to Adirai or consult with her about it before they did. That's why I know a great deal about you, but not everything. So you claim to be a Sagen as well?
Angelic sounded more than a little skeptical, and Jevon smiled.
Like Merlin himself, I simply say I possess some of the abilities legend ascribes to Sagens.
He shrugged.
Still, it's a convenient label.
He paused, regarding her levelly.
If I let go of your wrist, will you promise to leave yourself unpoisoned long enough for us to talk?
He asked her then, with a ghost of a smile.
Yes, she said. But only if you let go of my wrist and step back a bit.
She held his gaze, her own unwavering, and he spent a second or two, obviously contemplating her requirement. Then he nodded.
Very well.
He released her wrist and stepped back 3 strides. It was about as far as he could go in the small chamber, and he smiled again sardonically as he folded his arms in a manifestly unthreatening gesture.
Is this sufficient, my lady? He inquired. I suppose it will have to do, won't it?
She replied, although, having seen how quickly he could move, she suspected he was still more than close enough to stop her before she actually got the poison into her mouth.
Now, you were saying?
Angelic Panda sat up in bed, propped against a luxurious stack of pillows, breakfast tray across her lap, and gazed out her frosty window through the wisps of steam rising from the fresh cup of chocolate, clasped between her slim hands. The sun was just rising, touching the frost crystals on the window panes with iridescent gold and red, and her expression was serenely pensive. She frequently started her mornings this way, although she was seldom up quite so early, given the late-night hours she tended to keep. But although no one would have guessed it from her expression, she'd slept very little during the night just past, and her thoughts were far more anxious than her well-schooled expression might have suggested. Someone rapped very gently at her bedroom door, and she looked away from the window.
Yes?
Marlis is here, mistress. Sundaria Gottfried, Angelic's personal maid, replied from the other side of the closed door.
Come in then, both of you.
The door opened and Sundaria stepped through it, followed by Marlis. The contrast between the two women was noteworthy, and not simply because Sundaria was as neatly and soberly dressed as always, while Marlis wore an embroidered robe over her nightgown, and her hair tumbled loosely over her shoulders. Sundaria was a good 25 years older than Marlis, with slightly mousy brown hair, brown eyes, and an almost swarthy complexion from her Harchongi's mother. She was also at least 4 inches shorter than the golden-haired Silkayan. Yet there was abundant intelligence behind both women's eyes, and although Sundaria would never have passed the beauty requirements for one of Angelic's young ladies, she'd been in her mistress's service for close to 20 years. Indeed, although no one else knew it, Sundaria had known Angelic far longer even than that. "Yes, mistress?" Sundaria asked now. Although Angelic employed an official steward who doubled as her butler and majordomo, everyone in her household knew Sundaria was the true manager of that household.
"I have a few things you and I need to discuss, Sundaria," Angelic replied. "But first, I wanted to ask you, Marlis, what was your impression of Master Jevons?"
Marlis frowned thoughtfully. Not in surprise, because Madame Angelic was very protective of her young ladies. Most of her clients were well known to her, or had been vouched for by someone who was. On the occasions when someone about whom she knew nothing turned up, she generally quizzed whichever of her young ladies had spent time with him. All of them expected that, just as they knew a couple of the sturdy young armsmen Madame Angelic employed as footmen were always close at hand whenever they were in the company of someone with whom Madame Angelic was not already acquainted.
"I liked him, Madame," she said simply after a moment. "He was courteous, witty, generous, and a gentleman."
She wrinkled her nose charmingly.
"He didn't have any peculiar requests, and he was actually quite gentle. One of those men who seem as concerned with giving pleasure as receiving it. And," she smiled even more charmingly, "quite good at it, too."
"I take it the two of you actually spent a little bit of time talking as well?"
Angelic inquired with a smile of her own, and Marlis chuckled.
"A little bit," she admitted.
"It must have been nice to have the opportunity to talk to someone from home."
"Actually, madame, I've never really missed Silkaya that much."
Marlis grimaced.
"I don't think my mother's family approved of me after father died. Even before they figured out that if I had a vocation, it certainly wasn't with Mother Church."
She smiled again, considerably more tartly this time.
"Still, I have to admit I rather enjoyed being brought up to date on events in Silktown, and Abraham knew all the current scandals."
Marlis rolled her blue eyes, and Angelic chuckled.
"So I take it you wouldn't be unhappy if he should visit us again?"
"Oh, I think you could take that as a given, madame."
"Good," Angelic nodded. "I think that answers all of my questions, Marlis. Why don't you go and find your own breakfast now?"
"Of course, madame. Thank you."
Marlis gave an abbreviated curtsy and withdrew, and Angelic cocked her head at Sundaria as the door closed behind the younger woman.
"Yes, mistress."
Sundaria was the only member of Angelic's household who habitually addressed her by that title rather than madame.
"Our Silkayan visitor last night was rather more interesting than Marlis realizes,"
Angelic told her. Sundaria quirked one eyebrow, and Angelic snorted.
"As a matter of fact, if he's telling the truth, and I rather think he is, he's not a Silkayan at all. Or at least, he's not here on any of Silkaya's affairs."
"No, mistress?" Sundaria asked calmly when Angelic paused.
He says, and I'm inclined to believe him, that he's here as a representative of the Carisians,
Angelic said flatly. May I ask why you believe him, mistress?
Because he knows a great deal about me,
Angelic replied.
He knows about the material I sent Adarai. He knows about Ninian.
Her eyes met Sandaria's.
And, most disturbing of all, he knows about at least some of our guests.
I see. If Sandaria was alarmed, she showed no sign of it. She simply frowned thoughtfully, eyes half closed for a moment, then looked back at her mistress. I'm sure you've considered the possibility that he's being less than truthful with you.
Of course I have. Angelic shrugged. In fact, I raised that very point with him, in a manner of speaking. And he pointed out in return that if he were an agent of Clintan's, they wouldn't be wasting time trying to entrap me.
Unless they want you to lead them to those guests, mistress.
I know.
Angelic sighed, returning her gaze to the fire-struck frost on the bedroom window.
I think he's probably right, though, that Clintan would simply have ordered me arrested and put to the question.
There was the ghost of a tremor in her voice. No one who didn't know her extremely well would ever have noticed it, but Sandaria did know her well, and the maid's eyes narrowed slightly as she castigated herself for not noticing the locket around Angelic's neck. It did not constitute part of her mistress's regular sleeping attire.
But even granting that he's right about Clintan, Angelic continued, oblivious to Sandaria's reaction to the locket, it's always possible he's working for Reyno instead. We've seen Reyno keep things from Clintan until he's investigated them to his own satisfaction in the past.
True, mistress, Sandaria nodded. On the other hand, is it really likely he'd do something like that under the present circumstances?
I think not,
Angelic said slowly. She shook her head, slightly at first, then more firmly.
Given how urgently Clintan's been looking for them, I don't think Reyno would sit on any clues as to their whereabouts that might come his way. That's one of the reasons I'm inclined to believe Master Jevons.
One of the reasons? Sandaria repeated, raising an eyebrow once more.
One,
Angelic said, her smile going a bit off-center as she remembered Jevons' blinding speed and the impossible strength of his gentle grasp. Very well, mistress, Sandaria nodded, her complete trust in Angelic's judgment evident. What do you wish to do?
I'm worried about the circle, Angelic said flatly. To be honest, I'm astonished Clintan has waited this long, assuming Samuel's right about his plans.
Her lovely eyes darkened, shadowed with the premonition of a long-anticipated grief.
He won't wait much longer, though. I'm positive of that much. And when he moves, you know everyone he takes will be put to the question, at least.
Sandaria nodded again. Both of them knew exactly how efficient the Inquisition was at torturing information out of its prisoners. When the prisoners in question were the Grand Inquisitor's personal enemies, the interrogators could be counted upon to be even more ruthless than usual.
Samuel and Howard are the only two who know about us, Angelic continued. Or that's what I hope and believe at any rate. And I trust their courage completely. But if they're taken, we have to assume that eventually they'll reveal our involvement, however courageous they may be. And I'm afraid we can't be entirely certain none of our guests have communicated with their husbands. So it's entirely possible someone else could be broken and lead the Inquisition at least to his own family. Which in turn...
She shrugged, and her maid nodded.
Under the circumstances, Sandaria, Angelic said, I think we have to assume this man is who he says he is, And if he is, then we have to accept his warning that it's time to smuggle our guests out of Zion. Now.
Yes, mistress. Sandaria bent her head in an oddly formal bow, like an armsman acknowledging his liege's orders.
I'm afraid you're going to have to go shopping this afternoon.
Angelic smiled faintly.
See if you can find me some blue steel thistle silk.
Of course, mistress.
15. The Temple and Harriman and Market Streets. City of Zion, Temple Lands.
I don't suppose you have any good news for me, Willem?
Vicar Jaspar Clinton, Bishop General of the Order of Schuler and Grand Inquisitor of the Church of God Awaiting, regarded the Archbishop of Changwu with cold, unhappy eyes. His expression was no more cheerful than his eyes, and most members of the Order of Schuler would have felt a cold, solid lump of panic resting in their bellies like a frozen round shot, had Clinton turned those eyes and that expression upon them. If Willem Reyno felt any panic, however, he concealed it well.
"Not, I'm afraid, on the front you're inquiring about, Your Grace," he said with remarkable calm. "The latest reports from Coruscant do indicate that things may be taking a turn in Mother Church's favor there, but they're very preliminary, and like every message from Coruscant these days, rather badly out of date. The shipbuilding programs, in the ice-free ports at least, seem to be proceeding fairly well, although there are still bottlenecks and delays. Earl Thirsk seems to be making excellent progress with his training efforts, and Taro has finally begun its share of the building program. And, of course, I've shared Sea Blanket's reports on the Earl of Corus's suitability to Mother Church's ends."
He smiled faintly.
"None of which touches upon the matter about which you were inquiring, does it, Your Grace?"
"No, Willem, it doesn't."
There might have been a glimmer of respect for Reyno's calm demeanor in the backs of Clinton's eyes. On the other hand, there might not have been, too.
"So why don't you address the point I was raising?"
"Very well, Your Grace." Reyno bowed slightly. "We've had no success since my last report in locating the traitors' families. They appear to have vanished from the face of the world."
"I see."
Clinton seemed unsurprised by Reyno's admission. He leaned back in his chair, gazing across his desk at the Adjutant General of the Order of Schuler, and folded his hands across his belly.
"I imagine you figured out that I'm not very happy about this, Willem,"
he said with a thin, cold smile.
"Of course I'm aware of that, Your Grace. In fact, I would imagine I'm probably almost as unhappy about it as you are. Would you prefer that I promised you we're making progress on finding them when, in fact, I know we're not?"
Clinton's eyes glittered for a moment, but then his nostrils flared as he inhaled deeply.
"No, I wouldn't prefer that," he acknowledged, and it was true.
One of the reasons he valued Reyno so highly was that the Adjutant General wouldn't lie in an effort to cover his own posterior or failures. Clinton was certain there had been occasions upon which Reyno had managed news by refraining from bringing things to his attention at an inopportune moment. That was quite a different matter, however, from lying outright, and Clinton had encountered more than enough people who were stupid enough to do just that. They didn't seem to consider the fact that sooner or later the Grand Inquisitor would discover the lie, at which point the consequences would be even worse. He had additional reasons for valuing Reyno, though. Among them was the fact that the Archbishop had amply demonstrated his own loyalty. More than that, Clinton knew Reyno was well aware he himself could never aspire to the Grand Inquisitor's chair.
He had too many enemies, and not enough leverage to overcome them, which meant his present position was as high as he could hope to go, and that he would certainly lose the one he had if Clinton fell from power or withdrew his support, which meant Reyno had every reason to serve his superior with steadfast loyalty. Besides, the adjutant general was extremely good at what he did. True, Samuel Wilson's family had slipped through his fingers on the very doorstep of Zion, but that wasn't Reyno's fault. He'd had the woman and her brats under surveillance by no less than three of his most trusted inquisitors, all of whom had also disappeared that same evening. Clinton had come to the conclusion that at least one of those inquisitors must, in fact, have been a traitor. Preposterous though that might be, it was the only answer to Lisbeth Wilson's successful disappearance he could come up with. Yet he had personally reviewed the records of all three of the missing men. If one of them had turned traitor, nothing anywhere in his file would have suggested that possibility in advance. Clinton certainly hadn't seen anything which suggested to him that Reyno should have seen it coming, at any rate. And the adjutant general's current failure to locate the families of no less than three vicars and two archbishops who had made it to Zion, families they knew were almost certainly somewhere under their very noses even now, was extremely unusual. In fact, the Grand Inquisitor could think of only one other occasion in which Reyno had suffered a similar failure.
"So there's been no progress at all?"
"None, I regret to say, Your Grace." Reyno shook his head. "There's been no communication between any of them since they disappeared, and our agents throughout the city haven't turned up a single trace."
He paused a moment, then cocked his head.
"We could always have Stanton inquire about them."
"No."
Clinton shook his own head instantly.
"We might as well go ahead and ask them ourselves. For that matter, given the fact that we can't find their families, we have to at least consider the possibility that they might slip through our fingers themselves if they thought we were about to pounce."
Reyno nodded, although he wasn't positive he agreed with his superior in this case. Nicholas Stanton, the Archbishop of Hankey, was Clinton's mole within the group of reform-minded vicars who called themselves the Circle. In fact, it was Stanton who'd first revealed the Circle's existence to the Grand Inquisitor. It seemed obvious to Reyno that the other members of the Circle, or its leadership at least, must realize one of their number had betrayed them, although they obviously didn't know who. Personally, Reyno was at least half inclined to stake Stanton out. There were a couple of members of the Circle, Howard Wilson came to mind, who Reyno rather suspected would come out into the open to cut Stanton's throat. It wouldn't save them in the end, but they'd probably take a certain satisfaction out of it anyway. And when they did, it would be conclusive proof of their own guilt, which could be readily displayed for the remainder of the vicarate. It would be a bit hard on Stanton, but his value would disappear anyway the moment the Circle was broken. In Reyno's opinion, he'd be far more useful at that point as a martyr, whose death would have underscored the Circle's treason. And if it didn't underscore that treason, Stanton would be no great loss anyway. As far as the renegades realizing Clinton was simply biding his time before having them arrested, Reyno was certain they must have already recognized what was coming. At least one vicar, who'd been a member of the Circle for over 10 years, according to Stanton, had committed suicide the month before. Two more had perished in what looked like accidental deaths, although Reyno was confident appearances were deceiving.
"No, all three of them killed themselves," he thought again. "They decided that would be an easier end than the one the Book of Schuller lays down for heretics, and they probably decided it was the only way to keep the Inquisition from going after the remaining members of their families as well."
He didn't know if they'd been right about that last point or not. That would be Clinton's decision, and while the Grand Inquisitor's first inclination would undoubtedly be to make examples out of the traitors' families as well, he might choose not to. If he held his hand in that regard, it might encourage future enemies to take the same escape, remove themselves from the vicar's path, without putting him to the bother of having them removed. It would be interesting to see which approach Clinton chose in the end.
"And for now," Reyno thought dispassionately, "he's enjoying the knowledge that the others have realized what's coming. It's not as if they could get far in the coldest month of a Zion winter even if they tried to run, and in the meantime, they have to see him every day and know what's going to happen to them. And so does everyone else in the vicarate, whether they're willing to admit it or not."
That was the real reason Clinton had waited so long, Reyno was certain. It wasn't something the Grand Inquisitor was going to discuss in detail even with him, but Reyno hadn't served Clinton so long and so well without realizing how the vicar thought. Clinton had deliberately stoked the steadily growing fear within the vicarate, but not out of simple sadism, or even out of a simple desire to punish those who dared to challenge the Group of Four's control. No. He'd used the gnawing terror to hone the internal, factional tensions which always afflicted the temple during the winter months to an even sharper, more dangerous edge. He'd wanted to force decisions, to drive even those who traditionally attempted to stand aloof from the vicarate's internal political struggles to choose sides, to commit themselves. And he'd wanted them to do it under circumstances he controlled. His own command of the Inquisition and Elaine Maguire's command of the Temple Guard gave the Group of Four an absolute monopoly on force within the Temple and Zion, and the winter had trapped all of Mother Church's highest hierarchy right here. There was, quite literally, no countervailing force, which meant everyone knew Clinton was in a position to bring the full sledgehammer repressive power of his office down on anyone who marked himself out as the Group of Four's enemy. In the face of that sort of threat, it was scarcely surprising that even many who nursed serious doubts as to the Group of Four's handling of the crisis had found themselves looking for ways to prove their loyalty, to curry favor like a frightened dog, licking the hand which threatened to beat it in the hope of buying some sort of mercy, or at least of securing short-term survival, because even the dimmest dullard had to recognize that without short-term survival, there could be no long-term survival. No doubt it did amuse Clinton to use enemies and rivals to serve his own political ends. In fact, Reyno never doubted it did, and he supposed the streak of cruelty, even sadism, that demonstrated was a serious flaw. Yet he'd come to the conclusion long ago that all men had flaws, and that the greater the man, the greater the flaw tended to be. And the fact that Clinton enjoyed making his enemies suffer made his strategy no less effective. Besides, it wasn't as if any other strategy had ever truly been possible, for there could be no rapprochement between Samuel Wilson and Jaspar Clinton. It simply couldn't happen, if for no other reason because Clinton would expect other potential adversaries to see it as an act of weakness on his own part, as an accommodation he'd sought, because he doubted the strength of his iron fist. It was essential he prove he entertained no such doubt, and that he would not tolerate that doubt's existence in any other vicar's mind. To do that, he must use that strength. He had to crush his enemies, openly and utterly, and so he would. He might delay the moment, might stretch out the agonizing anticipation, in order to force others to offer him their submission. But the ultimate outcome had never been in doubt. It could never have been in doubt, lest it be seen as hesitation or timidity on his part. Reynaud understood that, and his own estimate was that Clinton had accomplished virtually all of his goals. Further delay would achieve very little in terms of the internal dynamic of the members of the vicarate likely to survive the coming purge. Which meant that, at this point, Clinton was holding his hand for purely personal reasons. Having achieved his political objectives in all their essentials, he was treating himself to the predatory satisfaction of watching his doomed foes suffering all the anguish of anticipation.
And if anyone else realizes that's what he's doing, it will only make them even more terrified of crossing him in the future. So even now, he's still killing two wyverns with a single stone, as it were.
The only flaw in the Grand Inquisitor's satisfaction was the possibility that some of his enemies' families might escape him after all. But neither he nor Reynaud were concerned by the possibility that anyone who hadn't already disappeared might do the same. Reynaud still hadn't figured out how the missing family members, and especially the Wilsons, had managed to vanish so thoroughly, although he'd come to suspect there was an additional player in the game. One Stanton didn't know about, and so had been unable to betray. There was a sense of craftsmanship to the family's disappearances, which reminded Reynaud strongly of the disappearance of Archbishop Arake Dinis's family. He still hadn't been able to figure out how that had happened either, but he'd developed a grudging respect for whoever had managed to get them out of the temple lands and into Karras without leaving a single footprint behind. The adjutant general would cheerfully officiate over the fellow's execution, whoever he might be, but he did respect the quality of his opponent. However good that opponent might be, however, none of the other families were going to disappear. All of them were under constant surveillance, and he'd handpicked the inquisitors responsible for keeping them that way. Of course, he'd done that in the Wilson's case as well, but this time he'd assigned double teams to each family, and it struck him as extraordinarily unlikely that he could have that many traitors, if that was truly what had happened in the Wilson's case, in his own ranks. No, the other families weren't going anywhere without his knowledge. In fact, he rather wished some of them would make the attempt. If they did, they might yet lead his inquisitors to the others, and he'd become privately convinced that that was the only way he was going to find those others at this point. Not that he had any intention of giving up the hunt. And, meantime...
Have you given any more thought to exactly when you wish to have them arrested, Your Grace?
He asked after a moment.
I think we can give them another 5 days or so, don't you, Willem?
The adjutant general's question seemed to have restored the Grand Inquisitor's humor, and he smiled jovially.
There's no need to cut the others' time with their family short, now is there?
I suppose not, Your Grace.
Reynaud returned his superior smile with rather more restraint. Unlike Clinton, Reynaud would take no personal satisfaction from the Grand Inquisitor's enemies' destruction. Nor was he particularly looking forward to having the members of their families put to the question in front of them. It was, he acknowledged, one of the most effective of the Schulerite's techniques for extracting information, and their inability to apply it to the family members who had escaped probably helped explain at least some of Clinton's frustration. For himself, however, Reynaud would be just as happy to avoid as much of that sort of thing as he could. It was unlikely to be necessary in any case. They had plenty of evidence already. They could count upon the accused to confess in the end. The accused always did confess in the end, didn't they? And aside from a few junior bishops and archbishops who'd managed to get out of the city before winter closed in, they could put their hands upon the guilty parties any time they chose. Even those who'd contrived to get out of Zion had only delayed the inevitable. They were all being watched by trusted inquisitors, who were simply waiting for the semaphore message to take them into custody.
I suppose it's remotely possible one or two of them might manage to escape, at least briefly, but not more than one or two, and anyone who does run won't get far.
No one who knew Lisbeth Wilson would have recognized her in Shantahal Blondie's warm but extremely plain Harchong-style poncho, worn over an equally utilitarian hooded woolen coat. At least, Lisbeth thought, as she tucked her mittened hands into her armpits under the poncho, burrowed her chin deeper into her woven muffler, and hunched her head against the wind. She devoutly hoped they wouldn't have. She'd always hated Zion in the winter. Her husband's estates lay in the southern Temple lands, just across the border from the princedom of Tanshar. Lisbeth's own family, although it had connections to quite a few of the great church dynasties, was Tansharan. And while winter could be cold enough along the Gulf of Tanshar, it was never as bitterly frigid as winter in Zion. Her husband had been born barely 5 miles on the Temple Land side of the border, and he fully understood and shared her distaste for Zion winters. He seldom insisted that she join him here for the winter months. He hadn't planned on her joining him this winter either, and for considerably more weighty reasons than her dislike for snow. In fact, he'd sent her word, very discreetly, that he thought it would be wise for her to make alternate travel plans. Unfortunately, she'd become aware, even before his message arrived, of the fact that she and the children were being watched. It hadn't been anything most people would have noticed, but Lisbeth Wilson wasn't most people. She was a smart, observant woman who'd recognized when she accepted Samuel Wilson's proposal that wedding a husband from that particular dynasty was inevitably going to embroil her in temple politics. The notion had repelled her, but despite the differences in their ages, Samuel most definitely had not. Her lips twitched in bittersweet memory, and she'd shared his outrage over what Mother Church had become. She hadn't expected things to get this bad, not really. No one ever really expected the end of their world, even when they genuinely thought they were prepared for it. Yet she'd always been at least intellectually prepared for the possibility of disaster. And over the last couple of years, especially since the Group of Four's disastrous assault on the Kingdom of Karas, she'd been quietly taking precautions of her own. And unlike the other members of Samuel's circle within the vicarate, Lisbeth had known who the true hub for the reformists' communications had been. When Adarai Dinis had been forced to flee to Karas following her husband's arrest, she'd passed her own responsibilities on to Lisbeth. In the process, she'd had to give Lisbeth certain information only Adarai and Samuel had possessed, which meant Lisbeth had become aware of Angelic Panda's importance to the circle, even though almost no one else in the circle had entertained the least suspicion of that importance. So far as Lisbeth knew, she and Samuel, and Samuel's brother Howard, were now the only people in the Temple Lands who knew about Angelic's connection to the circle at all. So when she'd realized she and the children were being watched, that any effort to flee would be instantly intercepted, she'd decided on a plan of her own. Instead of staying away from Zion, she'd written, openly, using her privileges as a senior vicar's wife, to send it over the church semaphore, to tell Samuel she'd be joining him there this winter after all. And she'd made arrangements to do just that. Then she'd made rather different and much quieter arrangements with Angelic. She hadn't expected all three of the inquisitors who'd been spying on her to end up dead in the process, but she hadn't shed any hypocritical tears over their demises either.
Unfortunately, Angelic's initial plan to immediately get her and the children out of the temple lands had proved unworkable, in light of the clandestine but intense search for them which Willem Reyno had instigated. The open hunt for her family's abductors would have been a serious obstacle under the best of circumstances. Yet it was Reyno's ruthlessly efficient secret hunt which had inspired Angelic's caution.
And her determination to get as many other families out of the city as she can, Lisbeth reminded herself now.
The selfish mother in her, the mother who wanted her children in safety and shun away with anyone else's children, bitterly resented that decision on Angelic's part. Most of her, though, agreed entirely. Despite her terror for her own family's safety, she knew that simply abandoning anyone else they could have saved would have been a betrayal of everything the Circle had ever stood for. And since her husband and her brother-in-law, and most of their dearest friends in the Vicarate, were going to die for what the Circle had stood for, Lisbeth Wilson could no more have betrayed their cause than Angelic could. None of which had made the nerve-wracking 5 days hiding here in Zion, the city which had become the heart of the beast itself, any easier to endure. The good news was that Chantahal Blondi didn't look at all like Lisbeth Wilson. She was older, her hair was a different color. She had a prominent mole on her chin, and she was at least 30 pounds heavier than slender, youthful Madame Wilson. Not only that, but whereas Madame Wilson had been accompanied by both of her sons and her daughter when she disappeared, Chantahal had only a single son. It was amazing how skilled someone who'd followed Angelic's vocation became when it came to matters of cosmetics and hair dye, and winter clothing made it far easier to pad one's figure without anyone noticing. And while most mothers wouldn't normally have wanted their 12-year-old daughters and 8-year-old sons spending the winter in what was, however elegant it might be, a house of ill repute, Lisbeth had no concern in Jeannette's or Archibald's case. In fact, she couldn't think of any place they might have been safer, and her greatest concern had been that one of them, especially Archibald, in view of his youth, might inadvertently betray them all to the Inquisition. Her older son, Thomas, on the other hand, was 14 now, a serious boy who already shared his father's sorrow and anger over what Mother Church had become. He was his uncle's nephew as well, however. Like Howard, he'd been headed for a career in the Temple Guard, and despite his youth, he was a skilled swordsman and an excellent shot, whether with a matchlock musket, an arbalest, or a standard bow. He was also fiercely protective of his mother, and he'd flatly refused to join his younger brother and sister in hiding. Truth to tell, Lisbeth hadn't tried all that hard to convince him to do so, partly because she recognized his father's son and knew a futile endeavor when she saw one, but mostly because as much as she trusted Angelic, and as effective as Angelic had always proved herself to be, Lisbeth hadn't quite been able to bring herself to put all of her eggs in one basket, which was also the reason Angelic had made completely different arrangements to whisk Lisbeth's oldest daughter, well, stepdaughter, technically, although she was the only mother Erase had ever actually known, and her husband and son out from under the Inquisition's nose. Lisbeth suspected that her own willingness to come to Zion had been a factor in Angelic's ability to do just that. She'd been so clearly willing to walk directly into the spider's web that the Inquisition's vigilance over Sir Freyman Jardot and his wife and daughter had lapsed at least a little. She'd rejoiced in quiet, fervent gratitude when Angelic got her word that Freyman, Erase, and young Samuel had made good their escape, at least for the present. But now, under a wind-polished sky of frozen blue, as she made her way along an icy sidewalk, half-blocked by overnight snowdrifts, their centers trampled down by the feet of earlier traffic, she felt the familiar weight of despair. Not for her own safety, and not really for the safety of her children and grandchild, although that was a much sharper, more bitter-edged anxiety than any she might feel for herself. She had no intention of becoming careless, yet she'd come to the conclusion that if the Inquisition had been going to find her or her children, they would have done so by now. No, the despair she felt was not for herself, but for her husband and all he'd striven for so long to accomplish. For the friends and trusted colleagues who'd given him their allegiance and their assistance, and who were going to share in his agonizing death when the moment came. "It's not as if he tricked or deceived any of them into supporting him," she thought, hugging herself more tightly under her poncho as the keen-toothed wind whistled between the tenements on either side of the street. "All of them were as angry and determined as he was, and all of them knew this could happen. Yet to know it is going to happen, that someone like that greedy, bloody-minded bastard Clinton is going to win after all." Lisbeth had no way of knowing how her own thoughts, her own anger at God for allowing this to happen, mirrored her brother-in-law's reaction. If she had known, it wouldn't have surprised her. She'd known Howard as long as she'd known Samuel, and in many ways, she and Howard were more alike than she and Samuel, which was, probably, the reason she'd been so much more strongly attracted to Samuel from the very beginning than she'd ever been drawn to Howard, as a husband and a lover, at least. As a brother-in-law, he'd always been her favorite. Dearer to her, in fact, though she would never have admitted it, than either of her birth brothers. There was a reason she'd been so content to see Thomas taking so strongly after his uncle, for she couldn't imagine a better pattern he could have chosen for himself. She reached the corner where Harriman Street met Market Street, halfway between her cheap, spartanly furnished tenement apartment and Zion's third largest market, and glanced across the street at the milliners. She didn't even pause as she turned the corner, and her stride never hesitated, but her eyes first widened, then narrowed, as she saw the shop window. A bolt of blue fabric, steel thistle silk, she thought, was displayed in that window, and the shop's coal heaver must have spilled a couple of large lumps of coal just on the other side of the barred delivery gate when he made the morning's delivery. Someone had spilled them there, at least. Lisbeth could see the glittering black chunks, starkly visible against the dirty snow, just far enough inside the gate that none of the city's desperate poor could glean them. It took only a single glance to note the silk and the coal, and she bent her head a little more deeply as she found herself walking directly into the wind now. She would continue to the market, she thought. It was Shantahall's regular shopping day, and she would chaffer for the ruinously expensive potatoes and winter woody carrots she'd come to purchase. She might even pick up a few onions, assuming they weren't too pricey this late in the winter, before she headed back to her tenement once more. Whatever she did, however, she would give no sign and no indication at all that she'd seen that blue silk or those lumps of coal. That she'd recognized in them Angelic's warning to be ready to move on an instant's notice. 16. Madame Angelic's townhouse and the temple, City of Zion, the temple lands. Abraham Jevons gazed into the mirror at his hazel eyes and brown hair. There was a faint, very faint, family resemblance to Merlin Athrawis and Nemu Albin, he thought. Something about the lips that he hadn't managed to randomize as much as he'd intended. He wondered if his subconscious had been responsible for that, or if it was simply a quirk in the Pika software which had carried over. Prior to her cybernetic reincarnation,
Nemu had never been particularly interested in the software which allowed Apika's appearance to be modified at will. She'd been more interested in its applications for extreme sports. For that matter, she'd never really wanted Apika at all. It had been a gift from her wealthy father. She simply hadn't had the heart to turn down. So she was nowhere near as well versed in the cosmetic aspects of her current physical avatar as she might have been, and it was possible something in its software might have been responsible for the carryover.
Sure it could have been,
Abraham thought sardonically.
But it wasn't. You know that perfectly well, Merlin.
It was odd, he thought, turning away from the mirror. He still thought of himself as Merlin, rather than as Nemu or Abraham. Probably because that was who he'd been for the last few years. Or possibly because he'd finally accepted that Nemu was dead and he was someone else entirely. Or possibly again, simply because he needed a single identity upon which to hang his sense of personhood if he wasn't going to go completely off the deep end. Which might also explain that little glitch about the lips.
Well, no one's going to notice anyway, even if they've seen both Abraham and Merlin, he told himself. Not once Merlin regrows his mustache and his beard, at any rate.
He looked out the window of his hotel room. It was snowing again. It did a lot of that here in Zion, and he wondered once more if the Archangel's choice of the city's site had been made solely to make the mystically maintained internal comfort of the temple even more impressive to those who beheld it. More probably, though, he'd decided, the original decision to put the colony's planetary HQ in this particular spot had been made because the climate was so bad it was likely to discourage the low-tech colonists and their descendants from settling in the area. Back before the destruction of the Alexandria Enclave and Commodore Pei's retaliatory attack on Langhorne and Bedard, there'd been no temple. Merlin had come to suspect that Langhorne and Bedard had seen the site of their headquarters as something along the lines of a barely accessible Mount Olympus, somewhere beyond the normal reach of mere mortals, yet with sufficient proximity to those mortals' world to provide a sense of archangels hovering permanently just over the horizon. The climate wouldn't have been a problem for them, after all, and the fabulous palaces of the archangels would have helped bolster the command crew's divine status for any colonists who did visit here. He had no proof of that, of course. On the other hand, a couple of references in Commodore Pei's download had hinted at that sort of thinking, and it was entirely probable that Chihiro and Schuller, who'd apparently emerged as the Archangel's leaders after Commodore Pei's vest pocket nuke destroyed the original HQ, had followed the same line of thought. And it was also distinctly probable that they'd deliberately rebuilt on the same spot to emphasize the victory of the powers of light over Shan Wei's dark legions from hell as well. Just as they'd built the entire temple as a tangible reminder of the Archangel's power.
It would have made sense, in a way, Merlin thought again, watching snowflakes dance on the sharp-edged, steadily rising wind. After so many of Langhorne's people went up in the Commodore's fireball, they'd need something to remind the colonists the Archangels had won after all. Might have been a bit hard to convince everyone of that, given the casualties they'd taken, without something pretty drastic to drive the point home.
Whatever the logic behind it, it was a thoroughly miserable place to put the planet Safehold's biggest city, in the winter at least. In the summer, it was quite a different matter. On the other hand, summer in Zion was a fleeting experience, one that wouldn't be around again for quite some time, which had unfortunate implications for Abraham's immediate future plans. As he told Michael Stainer, he'd kept a surreptitious eye on Angelic Panda ever since Adirai Dinis's astounding revelations had suggested just how much more angelic was than Merlin had originally assumed. He'd taken extraordinary precautions, using remotes that recorded their data and were then physically retrieved, rather than transmitting, however stealthily, to his orbital communications arrays. That had bottlenecked his surveillance badly, but it had also provided an additional level of security, which, given those power sources under the temple, had seemed highly advisable. It had also, unfortunately, made it impossible for him, or Owl, to reposition those remotes on the fly the way they could elsewhere. In Zion, he couldn't move his pickups to independently track individuals the way he could anywhere else on the planet, which meant he had far less complete information than he could wish he had. Despite that, however, he'd realized over the last 5 days that Angelic had been at her dangerous game even longer than he'd assumed after Adderai's revelations. In fact, he'd come to the conclusion that Angelic had probably contacted Samuel Wilson, rather than the reverse. Merlin had resisted that possibility when he first became aware of it. Not because of any doubts about Angelic's capabilities, but because she'd obviously been only the communications relay for Wilson's organization. Given what Merlin had seen of young Pater Wilson in Karis, and what he'd been able to glean from what his Telesburg remotes had been able to examine, once Stainer had agreed to permit it, of the documents Adderai had delivered to the Archbishop, it was apparent that the Wilson family's involvement in efforts to reform the vicarate had been a multi-generational affair. On that basis, it had been obvious Samuel must have recruited Angelic. "But that isn't what happened at all," he mused. "Unless I'm mistaken, what really happened is that Angelic became aware of his organization and put herself at his service to manage his communications. But she had her own organization already up and running before she ever contacted him, and she never combined the two. That's why she was able to get Adderai and her boys out of the temple lands so smoothly. And it's how she managed to disappear Lisbeth Wilson and the others.